I rewrote my dissertation on Michelangelo's drawings. And the whole bent was, it's not an academic book. It's for the general public. And what it essentially is, since I studied his drawings by copying 135 of his drawings twice over in the same materials, even from the originals in the U.S. and Britain, in France, in even in Italy, the concept was is to find out how he learned how to draw and how he learned how to become Michelangelo.
I'm Martino Correa, and you are off the coast of Utopia. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Alan Pascuzzi, an American painter, sculptor, author, and teacher living and working in Florence, Italy. Dr. Pascuzzi recently held a major exhibition of Madonna and Child sculptures in Rome and is currently working on a number of commissions in his Florentine studio. His doctoral thesis, which chronicled his journey in studying the work of Michelangelo, is about to be released as a book entitled Becoming Michelangelo. I hope you enjoy.
Right now, at the moment, I have 10 Madonnas, life-size Madonnas, in a 25-meter square space, and no room whatsoever.
Is that all commissions?
No, those were all the Vatican works. Those were all the Vatican
works. All the work from your show?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. How did that come together?
Actually, 1 year ago yesterday, I was called to the Vatican through a friend of mine to propose an exhibition at the Vatican. So I went there and proposed an exhibition based on a medieval hymn called Tota Pulchra Est Maria, so How Beautiful is Mary, because this association, it's a cultural association headed up by this French Monsignor, was looking for religious artists to exhibit their works, right?
Yeah.
So I went out there and I proposed a show based on the hymn that was also the title, that was also the name of their association. So I tried to hit him right where, you know, right where it was going to really get to him. And they said, sure, let's do it. And they looked at, you know, these Madonna sculptures that I did, and they asked me to have it all done by December of 2018, which was a bit of a push. But I said, yeah, sure. I mean, I don't want to lose the opportunity. So did all the small models, and then they approved that. And then they didn't have any funds of their own to sponsor it. So I had to basically sponsor everything by myself.
Oh, of course. But, usual thing.
Yeah. I mean, I rented the spaces at the Palazzo della Cancelleria right by the Campo dei Fiori,
mm-hmm.
and executed 10 works. Worked like I'd never worked before. I mean, ridiculous. Put them in a truck and went down there and exhibited them, and just, you know, went from there. And now I'm trying to bring it to other space. I'm trying to do like an itinerant show with the same works. I'm trying to eventually sort of leave them in monasteries or convents.
Are these works in plaster?
These are. I did the originals in clay. Then I did a negative cast, and then I did the final copies in a white resin. Fairly resistant, lightweight, durable material.
Oh, that's
so they
cool.
work really well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They work. It worked really well. I mean, I thought there was going to be a bigger response, as in like sales and stuff like that, but it's just not the moment, nor the moment. But you know, you do it, you know, you just do it.
Well, you still have the pieces, right? So now it's just a matter of marketing them and getting them
sold. Yeah. I mean, I'll probably end up like I've been trying to do something here in Florence. I'm trying to get a venue here in Florence to do it. Because in Rome it's a whole different idiom, and then also have all the small models and do a marketing thing with the small models. But you need an agent. You need an agent to sort of push that for you, because I've tried to do it myself, and like I went to Cheruti and these other stores, and they just the religious art is out there, which is very sort of, you know, plastic Padre Pio's and stuff like that. And people are more used to that than they are, like, you know, real religious art. So you have to couch it.
But there's a market there, I think, for something that's like, well, like you said, you put them in this lightweight resin, so it's like they're durable. They can be shipped without a huge expense. Original. They're more beautiful than like the mass-produced things, but people don't know, right? So that's what matters. You're right. You need a full-time agent or full-time person working for you.
Right. The only thing is, like, what I did was I did small models, like 20 by 20 centimeters, then secondary larger models, 30 by 40, and then you got the big ones. So what I tried to do was cover the whole, like the trinket, the, you know, the semi artwork, and then the big full artwork. But it, you know, what I realize is that I have to sort of create, you have to create like a website. And because if you go on the internet and go and look at these websites, you know, for the religious art, you see all this stuff, and there's an, like, plastic, you know, Pope Francis's and stuff like that for like 70 euro and stuff like that. You also have to have the production behind you, and I have a guy out in Calenzano who actually is willing to do all the production stuff, because you got to have pull out like 2,000 if you have to send them out if they sell, because you can't do it by yourself.
No, you can't. You need somebody that's like got two or three artists. There's work there for someone that can organize it, can like take two or three artists and just push them full time, you know?
Oh gosh. No, and that's what I think.
I need somebody like that. You need somebody like that. Donnie needs somebody like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think we're in an extremely narrow but lucrative niche that many people don't know that it
exists.
That we exist. And don't know that it's still possible. That it's still possible to, because I know there are people out there. Well, I mean, the commissions that you get are the examples. But as far as the, you know, things that allow you to break ground and move in new directions, especially with religious art, which has been stagnating, you know, for decades.
Yeah.
I mean, heck, you've got a degree in it for Pete's sake. And, you know, you have, I mean, the people who just do it as symbols are making more money than the people who do it, who know the theology behind it.
This is the world we live in.
Right. Yeah, it really is. You're almost overqualified to do what you're, you know, what
qualified
you're doing.
To do.
Which is unfortunate, but you know, what can you do?
You've got a book coming out, so could you tell?
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious a little bit about that. Is it based on your PhD thesis, or?
Yeah, it 20 years in the making. When I finished my PhD thesis, I wrote on 135 of Michelangelo's drawings, and in order to publish one drawing at that point, it cost about $400 to buy the publication rights. So it would have cost me about $700,000 to publish in 1999, and I didn't have that type of money.
But now you do.
Of course. Yeah. Now I'm just swimming in it. So it all started. This was like in 2011. A student of mine at New York University. She said that she worked at the university, New York University Press, right? So I said, listen, would New York University, since I was a professor there, I said, would they be interested in publishing my dissertation? She came back to me. She actually asked, and she said no, that they couldn't. But in 2015, I get an email from the same student who had since graduated. Now she worked for a publishing house. And she said, listen, we're looking for books to publish. Would you still be interested in publishing the book? And I said, yeah. I wrote a proposal. sent it in, you know, and even the proposal took a long time. And then she, it took me like 2 years because then I was in Australia and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. everything was like hit the fan, right? And then, she writes back and says, "Oh, I'm leaving the publishing house. Sorry, I can't help you anymore." And it's like, "Oh, geez, damn." So I wrote the editor, head editor, and I said, "Listen, would you still be interested in this?" And he said, "Yeah, I think it might go." So I rewrote my dissertation on Michelangelo's drawings, and the whole bent was it's not an academic book; it's for the general public. And what it essentially is, since I studied his drawings by copying 135 of his drawings twice over in the same materials, even from the originals in the US and oh, wow. Britain, in France, even in Italy. The concept was to find out how he learned how to draw, and how he learned how to become Michelangelo.
Oh, wow.
And this all started when I was a master's student at Syracuse, and I was extremely depressed because I was in the library. I couldn't get any art going anymore. So I said, and I read in this 13th, you know, Cennino Cennini, this one treatise yeah. saying, if you want to learn art, you've got to pick one master and just copy everything by him. So I started to copy Michelangelo drawings. And then, cause I wanted to, you know, learn anatomy and materials. And then what I realized is that there were these interesting characteristics that were popping up. Like I was doing one drawing from 1520, which was a lot more complex than a drawing that I did in 1504, right? So I thought, well, that's interesting. What if he actually learned? What if he actually got better as he drew, right? Which is, you know, wow, Michelangelo, he was already a genius. So that, and I based my whole PhD on him. My whole PhD was based on this. And I just went to a Michelangelo professor, and so it's one guy in Washington University in St. Louis, and I said, listen, this is more I want to study. And the art historians couldn't touch me because I was using art to study art history, yeah. which is like, you know, totally radical. I mean, what does art have to do with art history? So no one could touch me, and they all, you know, sort of poo-pooed me. I mean, they just sort of thought I was some frustrated artist trying to do art history, right? So, and then I got a Fulbright out of it, and then they woke up. And then they started to ask me, you know, oh, you know, what do you think about this? And I was totally disgusted by that point with all of them, so I didn't really care what they thought anymore. But so what it is, I rewrote the book as a general public book for the general public, telling the story basically of what I just said from the moment I decided to start an apprenticeship to Michelangelo when I was a master's student. Rewriting the history of Michelangelo by showing that he tried to hide his humble apprentice beginnings, and how the evidence is there. It's just been convoluted. Like we have drawings that show he was copying from model books. And then we have accounts from Vasari, who tried to tell Michelangelo's early life as a boy genius, when in actuality he was following an apprenticeship. It's just been twisted and turned, sort of like fake news on Michelangelo, in order to show him as a genius. And then essentially, and this is the difficult part of the book, is to show and I think only artists know this, is the mental transformation, the maturation of your creative impulses, how they mature, how you get into this, you know, this groove, this mental state that matures even without you even doing anything, but you have to get to that level. I don't know if that makes any sense where.
No, I think it does. You have to just keep working.
You have to keep working. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And the more you work, the more, but you know, it's not serendipitous. It's something that you really have to work at. I mean, you have to pay your dues, and it's a concept of mastery that, you know, you can see it in people's works, like your work, that if you've never touched it, if you've never gotten there, you just don't understand it. You just don't understand it. So becoming Michelangelo, the whole concept is his technical transformation, his mental transformation, all told in sort of like a parallel autobiography. But I'm not trying to, you know, tell my own story. It's just that I use myself as like a guinea pig in order to pull out the truth of Michelangelo, to tell everyone how he becomes how he became Michelangelo.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
it's sort of interesting. I mean, not because I wrote it. And the main thing is that the Sistine Chapel ceiling, I finished with the drawings of the Sistine Chapel ceiling. The Sistine Chapel ceiling for Michelangelo was not his greatest work. The Sistine Chapel ceiling was Michelangelo's finishing his apprenticeship that he started with Ghirlandaio. He didn't know how to paint. He didn't know how to compose large figure compositions. He made mistakes. And through his drawings, you can actually see him struggling like crazy. So the Sistine Chapel for him was him finishing just by pure brute force of working his apprenticeship that he had started, because he became a sculptor at 15 or 16. He never was a painter.
Right.
But he finishes his artistic formation doing, you know, one of the largest fresco commissions ever, which is, it could be sort of revolutionary and radical and stuff like that, but it's not my intent. I just want to tell a story.
Sounds like a great story. But also, there's two questions that I have in my head now. The first one is, did you go to the museums that had the original drawings and copy them?
Yeah. In fact, I start the book out. The whole book starts with me sitting in the British Museum. And the first sentence is, and there I sat in the British Museum in the British drawing cabinet with Michelangelo's study for Adam for the Sistine Chapel ceiling, the original.
Yeah.
And my perfect copy of it right next to it. Because I'd tinted the paper, I'd used sanguigna, and I tried to make it as exact as possible. And this is the God's honest truth. I finish it and I was like, hey, this is pretty good, right?
Yeah.
And I look up and I realize there's no one around me. Right? Okay. And I've got the original. I've got my portfolio. I've got my copy that's the exact same thing. And for a split second, I said, I could take the original and put mine back in the box. And I said, and since you give them the whole box, they wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I mean, and it was funny because, I mean, this is the God's honest truth. And then I decided not to, right?
Obviously,
I'm put in jail. But the whole concept was, there's a story in Michelangelo where he was copying from his master's drawings, and he slipped his original back in the portfolio of Ghirlandaio's because it was so good. And then he started to tell other people how he duped the master. And the whole concept of copying drawings from your master was to reach that level where you couldn't tell, you know, so the whole concept was, I mean, I did. I was at the British Museum, the Ashmolean, the Louvre, the Uffizi, Casa Buonarroti, Cleveland, New York, the Met. And I pulled up the originals and I couldn't copy the pen drawings because you couldn't use a wet, material next to the drawings, but, the black chalks and the red chalk ones, like there's one in Cleveland that's one of the best.
Which one is that?
Harlem. That's, it's for one of the nudes. It's one of the last nudes in the Sistine Chapel ceiling. It was bought in the 1920s by this one family, and it's in the Cleveland Art Museum. It's okay. You know, absolutely fantastic. And then there's the famous one in the New York Met, the drawing, the sketch for the Libyan Sibyl. And I was able to copy that from the original. That was really cool.
Where's that? Sorry.
That's the New York Met. That's the New York Met, Metropolitan.
That's drawing. Well, that drawing is like, you know, the most famous.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, it's, you know, over the top. And then the other ones, you know, at the Uffizi, a lot of them I did with from really good facsimiles. But, you know, the British, when you call up Michelangelo drawings in the British Museum, they just wheel out a cart of like six boxes, and they're some of the most, you know, important drawings, and they just leave them there with you there. And
yeah, but this is what, 25 years ago?
This was 1997, 98. Okay, but then I went back there in 2006, and I called up the drawings because there's one drawing which I think has a the head of Jehovah on it. It's a sketch in faded charcoal. So I I've been trying to get them to do an infrared reflectology photograph of it, but they refuse. They've been refusing. And I'm hopefully if this book comes out, they'll accept to do it, because basically they told me they're just stains on the sheet. So things have changed. Like the Uffizi, you can't copy anymore.
Yeah, that happens. About 2005 or four or something like that. Yeah.
Well, you were here. Someone made a mark on a drawing or something.
Yeah,
like that?
Was
that
a student from an unnamed Florentine American Academy? An unnamed Florentine Academy. abused the drawing or did something wrong with the drawing, and that was it. Everybody was
I remember when it happened.
About 2003, 2004, something like that.
Right.
Or even earlier, 2002 perhaps. I think 2003. Yeah. So, yeah.
I remember when that happened.
But of course, we both know Massimo, so he works in the museum there. Yeah. So he's always you can come in.
Anyway, yeah, so I did copy from the originals, not all of them, but the ones I could get access to.
Do you still have the drawings?
Yeah, I still have them. Yeah.
That would be a great show.
The first ones I did are horrific. I mean, I did those when I was a master's student, and then I redid them.
Okay.
As a PhD student, and then over the years, I've actually redone other ones just to reanalyze them and stuff. Because when you copy a drawing, it's a way of analysis. You know, you analyze them. I actually did, when I was a master's student, I did actually an exhibition of them at the Villa Rosa. In fact, I spent more time doing that than actually my master's work. I mean, they were horrific. But, you know. Was just something to.
It was your apprenticeship to Michelangelo.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, the original title of the book was supposed to be Michelangelo's Last Apprentice.
Oh, okay.
But then the marketing team didn't like it. And then they came up with the title Becoming Michelangelo, which I actually liked better.
I like it.
It was.
Yeah.
It's just more to the point.
Yeah. That's really good.
So we'll see. It's being printed in China right now. It should be in the warehouses by May.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. It's I mean, there's no money in publishing.
No, but let's see if it leads to something else, right?
Well, I mean, it's funny because this. I'll be totally honest with you. Is that the PhD. Not ruined me. I don't want to sound like a victim, but and even my professor said that when I did the PhD, I had to bend myself out of myself. I mean, I'm not an academic. I just did academic stuff, and it burns your brains. And I think you know what I'm talking about when you get too academic and you just feel stifled and stuff like that. And the experience wasn't very good, just because I had people who were just, academics. You thought they would be more conducive to, you know, academic sort of exchange, but it was more of a constant moving, raising of the hoop, just to cause you, you know, pains. Like on my dissertation committee. My outside reader, who was a Michelangelo scholar, blocked my dissertation for 1 year because I had to rewrite a whole section of my last chapter that coincided with his personal theory of the chronology of the Sistine Chapel ceiling and just stuff like that. So, but anyway, it sort of bent the brain, and I mean, after I finished it, you know, I couldn't read a book for like 5 years. I just couldn't read a book, and I was even offered a position at my old college they offered me a position as art historian, and I was so burnt, and you could say bitter, that I didn't accept it. And that one opportunity that I missed, whether it was good or bad, it comes back and kicks me in the butt every once in a while.
So when was that?
I was in 19. I just finished my PhD in 1999. They called me over there, and the retiring art historian said, "Listen, I'll give you everything. I'll give you my notes. I'll give you the office. I want you here." And it freaked me out. I couldn't do it. And that would have been hell. I was there. I wouldn't have done after what I've done, but it just and then after the PhD, it was a constant sort of trying to get back to, you know, the art part, and it's just been back and forth ever since.
Yeah, you know, the life of an artist. So at what point did you actually settle in Italy?
That was. Yeah, I mean, because I was here in 1990 to study. Then I came back, did my master's in 1991 to 1992. Then came back in 94 to do doctoral research. And then in 95, came with a Fulbright. And then when the money ran out, I started to teach. And that's when I finished my PhD, when I finished the dissertation and everything, there were no jobs back in the States for Renaissance art historians. And at that point, I wasn't in a position to even teach art, even though I researched all the Renaissance techniques. I didn't know how to take advantage of it. So the jobs were here. So it just sort of evolved. Just sort of when a job comes up, you went, and then when that ended, you found another one.
Yeah.
And then just stayed on.
Now everybody's coming to Italy to do workshops. Like everyone's doing a workshop in Rome or Florence, and it's not the same.
Competition is ridiculous.
It's huge, yeah. So you got to build something else, right? But and there's all those the star artists. Those guys, they're all coming to Florence now or to Italy, and so they of course get the draw, right? Whereas before we were the only gig in town kind of thing. So
you were the only gig.
Yeah.
You guys are doing stuff. I think Florence Academy was doing stuff, but you guys, you guys were one of the only ones. I mean, you had the
Florence. There's so much competition too, but now it's huge. Yeah, it's just Well, even Florence has changed, man. Like last year when I was there, I was with all the Airbnb, all the local stuff has been. There's no local flavor anymore. It's almost like Venice. Worse than Venice actually, but. Yeah, it's really changed, man.
They've sold out. They've sold out. I mean, in fact, what's happening now in San Frediano, where I am, is that my studio is, the artisans, in order to stay alive, are cutting their workshops in half and making a Airbnb on one half, and then reducing where they work. Right. So at least they'll have some sort of income. So because the Airbnb I know there's a kid next to my studio who was a sculptor. I mean, he did the academy. He did a master's in Holland, and he couldn't find it. He couldn't do any work. So he's now running 150 Airbnbs in Florence. 150.
Yeah, you make good money on that. Money. Yeah.
He's working 7 days a week, and he's running around. But I said, "Are you doing any of your work?" And he said, "When?" He said, "I don't even get Saturday and Sunday off." He has to leave every 2 or 3 months, and he goes to Japan or Thailand or something like that. In fact, his sister, who works with him, went to Burma or something. I don't know where. And she's doing 10-day in silence a yoga camp in which they can't talk. They can't. I think they get bread and water packed because she just has to what it is generating. It's weird. Is that there's a things called the Airbnb experience. I think I told you about this. And then I'm doing these fresco things with that.
Well, that's good if you can tie into that. But I mean, yeah, it's.
But it's I mean, the Airbnbs that are regulated are okay, but there's, you know, it's funny. There was a story. One of the guys that was helping me during for the Vatican stuff, his girlfriend, the family had an apartment, right, in Florence, I think somewhere around the station, train station. And they're renting it to this Chinese kid. And then they get this notification from this one, a friend of theirs, saying, hey, I think I saw your apartment on the Airbnb website. And they were saying, that's not possible. They go on the website, and the apartment they were renting to this Chinese guy was on the Airbnb website. Oh, geez. And for over a year, this kid was renting out like rooms in the apartment, and he was making like money that he stopped going to school. He was making like good money, okay? And the people started – in fact, one of the other things was people started to notice a lot of people going up and down the stairs, right? Like, you know, every two or three days.
Yeah.
The guy was running an Airbnb in the apartment he was renting, and he was making like good money off of it, okay? And they had to kick him out. And at one point they were saying, well, why don't we just hire the guy to run it for? And well, they didn't. In fact, eventually his parents came from China and dragged him back to China, literally and figuratively. But the guy was running for over a year an Airbnb illegally and making you know, money off it. You know, in fact, they said he was really good because he even offered breakfast. He gave breakfast to the people. you know, it was like so. I mean, that's
good for him,
generating.
I suppose. But yeah,
I guess. But it's generating. It is sort of like it's like a trunk rot. I mean, you're making money off it, but you're. You know, you're just ruining the city and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah, I see it here.
One of my pet peeves is that our entire culture in the West, in these Western countries, well, worldwide really, is the only value that we have is economics.
Yeah.
Like if it doesn't make money, it doesn't have value, right? Yeah. So you see that reflected. There's an article that I had seen about modern dress, right? We dress so sloppily. As you look at old films, people are always dressed up and
nice.
They were less rich as a culture than we are. Well, it's because clothing doesn't have any monetary value. Just put on what's the easiest and cheapest, right? And that's reflected, well, culture-wide, right? So if anything doesn't have a monetary value, then it has no worth. I think that's reflected also in like the high rates of depression and, you know, problems that people have just... Generally, it's the culture of death, right? That Pope John Paul II talked about, right?
Right. New York University got rid of their art program in Florence because it didn't fit in with their global vision of education. Yeah. They fired us all. I mean, that for me was, you know, the
cutting point.
The kick in the head where, you know. You've got, you know, students coming into Florence for the art thing, and you get rid of your art program. I mean, even the art history, and they turned it into a political science, you know, political science program. You know, what can you do? I mean,
you just keep doing beautiful things, hopefully. But
it becomes the Middle Ages type of thing where you're the bubble. You know, you're the sheep among wolves, so to speak, and there's a constant, and I know you feel this as well. It's just a constant drag. You know, you're constantly being bombarded. Well, I mean, even the fact when you have no work. I mean, it's just a concept of, you know, it's like, well, what am I doing this for? You know, what do you do it for? And you don't want to seem stupid. I mean, and it's not like we're like modern artists, you know, trying to do the bohemian lifestyle, and we can't understand why no one wants our splash paintings. No, I mean, this is something that we're both doing something that's been a tradition of humankind
for
thousands of years.
Yeah.
So it is a Middle Ages. You know, you're the Dark Ages. I mean,
We're heading into a new Dark Age, I think. Something interesting, when I went to study with Odd Nerdrum, I spent some time with him. And I did some drawings or some paintings and whatnot. And he comes up to me and he's like, in another time, you would have been a very rich man, which I thought was a really, really nice thing to say. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I fully believe we just got the wrong century.
Yeah.
No, we did. We did. We just got the wrong century. I mean, I think there's always been people like us throughout history.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's not that we're wrong. It's just everyone else is wrong.
Everyone else is wrong. But but we would have had like a job in a studio or a studio head or, you know, our own studios. Who knows, right?
Well, like,
opportunity was made for that kind of.
And right.
There's new talents that are promoted now, right? But you know, television and film and whatnot. But
yeah. I truly believe that the most of the individuals who made money and who study, I mean, you have to have the big commissions in order to do the big works and stuff like that. I mean, and I think it was the big commissions that pull out the big stuff, the good stuff, and that's why I love these Australian commissions that I had, because, you know, I was on scaffolding and, you know, doing all that stuff. And it's very hard to pull out the big stuff just by pulling it out.
No, you gotta have
that pulls it out.
Yeah.
You know, and
you gotta have pressure. You gotta have time. You've gotta have
a
deadline. You've gotta have money.
Yeah.
A reward. Yeah, for sure.
Because you just can't do it, and
or you don't do it. Like, what's the purpose of doing it? Just to,
I mean, everything we saw. And I remember I was doing this tour for the Nazareth College, one of their vice presidents, and we were in Rome, and they were saying, well, you know, what should we give students if they come to Italy, right? And I said, well, why don't you just make it real. And I said, and we're in a taxi. We're right in front of Piazza Venezia in Rome, right? And I said, if you look at everything around you, and they didn't have any art background. I said, this isn't just, you know, like Disneyland. They're not doing it just to make everything you see was done by some artisan, craftsman, artist, whatever, who was getting money to do that doorknob, to do that, you know, stone cornice, to do that, you know, iron gate with all the decorations. I mean, that's the reality of it. I mean, that's the reality. It's like people were paid to do amazing things and that pulled out, you know, it's not just being done just for decoration. I mean, it was work. It was work. And that was I don't think people see that, you know.
But they also had another goal, right? Like, gets back to the whole economic thing. If you only value economics, then you just go for lowest common denominator. There they had a different emphasis. I mean, they're very much on beauty, right? And transcendental
right.
I mean, it comes back to the whole religious kind of Christian
beauty.
Yeah.
There's a guy, his name is Sergio Martelli. He's like in his 70s and he repairs antique firearms, right? And every once in a while, as he's coming, you know, walking down Via Campucho, he has this wooden box and he comes into my studio and says, you got to see this. And he opens up this box. This was like about a month and a half ago. He pulls out this pistol from 1680 or something like that. And he was doing all the mechanisms. But on the pistol, on the shaft and the handle, there's all these incised faces and figures. Now this is not a thing you're shooting people with, right? But all the, but it's got all these designs and decorations. And look at this stuff. And someone spent hours, literally hours, just, you know, making sure this head is perfectly, you know, and he said, this is just a pistol. This is just and even the, you know, the black powder container had designs, and it was in silver and stuff like that. you know, absolutely insane. And, you know, I think there is still a culture of that to a certain extent, but I think a lot of people have been, you know, it's been dead for a long time.
Yeah, I
you
think
that's right.
I think there's some people that know that love that, but
they don't have the money.
Yeah, the people that have money kind of do this cutting edge new stuff, and it's just so cold. It's so cold.
Right,
like
yeah.
I've been to some, some modern homes that are, you know, these cutting edge designs, and you look at the magazines, you're like, oh, it's like, it's interesting, but it's just cold, right? Like,
right. There's no warmth. No warmth. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. There's no wood. There's no, you know, anything orange.
And
or
there's odd angles, and
right.
That's like modern architecture, right? Like any new modern building has got these big curves to it, but then this kind of weird decorative stuff on the outside. Nothing human about it, really. It's kind of oppressive, and like
It's alienating. I feel alienating. Yeah. It doesn't really, you can't associate with it. Like, you know, you showed me a picture of all the designs and stuff you're doing, I think on the gown and stuff like that. And, you know, I love that stuff because, like, I think did I say God is in the details type of thing?
Yeah.
I don't know if I wrote you that thing, but, you know, even that stuff is, if you look at these paintings of the 16 and 1700s, I mean, or David and stuff like that, you know, the details and this stuff, and you can see them really relishing in this stuff. And, I envied you because it's like all the detailing and stuff like that, you know, just to paint that perfectly, you know, that's like, you know,
it was fun. It was
satisfying.
A lot of fun.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Yeah. You become like a decorator type of thing, but it's part of the whole beauty of the painting. I mean, that makes the whole, that detail, makes the, you know, it adds to the whole aura of the painting, and they're going to brag to people saying, "Look at the detail in the
well,
in
just
the
on
gown."
This, but it comes back to the whole thing of like, I think a lot of contemporary realism has gone so hyper realistic. It's like photorealistic. So I use photographs, but how do I balance that with kind of like getting the sense of the eternal behind it? You know, this kind of like conceptualization. And so like, I like doing that, but you know, how much detail do you need? So, you know, there's so much contemporary figurative art looks photographic. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, I don't think there's anything wrong with using photographs. They're a resource like anything else, but how do you make it not photographic, but somehow, you know,
I think it's in the way you paint it and personally, because I know what you're talking about. And I see this, you know, I think that's where your own soul comes in. I don't want to get transcendental, but I mean, if you're doing something just to reproduce it like a Chuck Close type of thing to make it photographic, then you just become this, you know, machine. But if your intent is to do something decorative, realistic, but beautiful, I think that's where the difference comes in. I think that's where the when you do a decorative thing on a gown, I think, I don't know, is that like brocade? Is that like gold? You know, something like
that?
That's beautiful. And I think if your intent is to do something, the beauty of that decoration, and then it gets enhanced just by your own personal sort of, you know, bent on it. But I think if people are just trying to do something realistic, you know, just to make it real, then it just becomes, you know, you're just reproducing. I don't know if that makes any sense. Like, you know, Chardin, his still lifes, they're realistic, but there's something to it, you know.
What is even that sense of, the transcendental, the eternal,
exactly. It's that extra oomph.
It's
the essence, and I think that's the difference of it. at least for me. And you know, it's funny because I do these fresco workshop, right now I have this I had this two people from Michigan yesterday who I came through a friend, right, and they'd never painted before, and I always tell them. And they never believed me. I said, listen, if you've never painted before, your true style is going to come out, because the fresco, you can't really think, you just sort of paint.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's great because it's like a psychological experiment, you know, and I don't want to get, I don't want to make it seem like I'm, you know, they're like guinea pigs, but here's a man and wife and they've never painted before. And she was like more Egon Schiele, right? You know, like really almost like, you know, expressive and, yeah. you know, German expressionism. And he was really careful. He was, you know, put everything in the lines and without them even knowing it, their true sort of like artistic, you know, id, you know, their essence what was coming out. And there really is something. I mean, it's interesting how it how art can bring that out, the essence of the person. And you've been doing that for, you know, for years. And I think that, I mean, for me, works, your, all of your works have a piece of you in it. And I think that's going to be that's eternal. And that's what I think is just so amazing about some of this stuff is that, you know, the concept of the eternal, I don't know, but I'm getting really freaked out now because, and I'm sure this happens to you, is that I'll go back to a sculpture or something that I did like 20 years ago and realize that hasn't aged. You know, I have.
Yeah.
and then I'm walking through the Uffizi on my birthday. I decided to just go through the Uffizi and stuff like that. And I realized that these paintings from the 1300s are immortal. They've outlived the person who did them. They've outlived generations who've come to see them. And that's extremely powerful. I mean, yeah.
They've outlived wars and famines.
Plagues. And everything. Yeah, I mean, earthquake. And so what you're doing is you're capturing, you know, and again, I don't know if you can be philosophical, but I'm just saying that
I think
when you do a work of art that's beautiful and you know, someone's paid you for it, and that person, you're capturing a moment in time and everything that's, you know, immortal. I mean, it's really powerful when you think about it. It has to be a good work of art that you've, you know, spent time on, because that's when you really transmute, you know, transmit, I should say, you know, what you are onto the canvas. And that's, you know, it's going to outlast you. And I think that's really cool. I mean, but no one really cares. That's the thing. But
I think a lot of people care, but a lot of people don't know that this exists. I think that what we are doing, a lot of like the other kind of contemporary, let's say contemporaryists, what we're doing it exists. It's just there's not the exposure. Mm-hmm. Even though we have, there are some people that are taking advantage of it. That are really promoting themselves, but each one of us needs to have someone working for us to promote us, because there's who has the time like to sit on and to post Instagram updates constantly, and you know, web YouTube videos, and you need a partner, right? Or someone.
Yeah, I think things have changed. The artistic mindset hasn't changed. It's just everything else around us is, you know, over the centuries sort of changed. And we're sort of fish out of water. You know, we're fish in the lake dried out, and the lake dried up, you know. Anyway.
Have you seen that documentary, Why Beauty Matters, Roger Scruton?
No.
Oh, gosh, I'll send you the link. He focuses mostly on architecture, but it's totally relevant to what we are doing. You know, beauty never will go out of style.
Right? It shouldn't.
Yeah.
It shouldn't. What's being considered beautiful is really weird. And I think people are afraid of it. I really think they're afraid of it, because it shows them just how probably simple they are, or just how unsophisticated they are. And they get scared. I noticed this with some of my, when I was doing some of the stuff for the Vatican stuff, I had people saying, well, why do the Madonna and Child? I mean, why all these Madonnas and stuff like that? I said, well, you got a mother, right?
Yeah.
and I was like, yeah, well, was, you know, isn't it nice to show, you know, mother and child? I mean, who hasn't had or experienced that type of bond, you know? And it doesn't have to be religious. I'd like the religious thing, but it's a universal thing. And you know, I, not that I had to defend it, but there were people who really, you know, were it's like, why? What's the point of doing something harmonic and you know, beautiful, not offensive?
Well, you can understand where they're coming from in a sense, like, oh, that's like that traditional kind of thing. And what about, because this whole idea of like the new and the cutting edge, and you know, most of that stuff is it's boring after like 20 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Or
even 5 minutes, but people will be doing mother and child paintings and sculptures forever.
Yeah. Well, the thing of it is that it's the cutting edge, it's the sound bite, it's the initial impact. Were you in Florence when they had that big, huge, they called it defecatio. It looked like a big piece of dog poop. Huge, right in the Piazza Signoria. Did you see
that? I've been there for the Piazza Signoria stuff.
Okay.
And when they had the Francis the Bacon exhibition with Caravaggio and Borghese in Rome. It was like Caravaggio and Bacon. It's like, no, just Caravaggio. I managed to see the entire show. I covered my eyes, not see the bacon. I was so proud of myself. I didn't look at a single bacon and saw all the Caravaggio. It's like, great.
Well, I mean, and that's what you have to, and that's, it's sort of demonic. I mean, why pull something beautiful down with something, you know,
they're trying to say that this is as valid as this, right? That this modern kind of artwork, and maybe it has some meaning, I don't know, but it doesn't have the same status as the works that are there, right? So that status only comes after like being there for 500 years. So we'll see what happens in 500 years. If those two works go, maybe they may go together. Maybe we're missing something.
Right.
I don't know, but it's just that we don't have a tradition anymore, right? Like anything goes.
Right.
As long as it's economically viable and it'll make money, it doesn't matter. So those things were all like economic considerations. The Florentine government was probably given a bunch of money.
Exactly.
And here's some, you know, whatever amount of money you can have, and we'll put these works in there, and it will make the city more appealing somehow. But people don't go to modern cities to look at the art. They go to Florence to look at the art and experience
the old
Florence
stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, the old stuff. And I think,
unfortunately, that's one.
I mean, the big.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I say that's one of the. Saying? What's one of the bad thing about Florence is that it's just a bit. It's kind of like a big shopping center, right? There's so many tourists all the time, as you know. It's been like that forever. But
gosh, no, it's getting worse.
No, it's getting worse. Yeah, it's getting worse. Well, it's gotten worse in the last few years. But to be there in the '60s, you know, would have been
interesting because you still had the artisan.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, even in the early 2000s and through the whole 2000s when I was there, San Frediano and the other side of the river, Alterano was all, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it has changed. And I think that's a historic change that we're sort of witnessing, a historic change. And, you know, you really can't do anything. You can't stop it. You just sort of live through it.
Yeah.
You sort of live through it. What I'd like to do now is working on some small bronze works, figurative works, male, female. But what's interesting is sort of not getting away from the religious, but turning the works into a more open, universal interpretation, where a figurative work of maybe like a Samson or a Daniel, doing it in such a way that it's the expression, the figural expression that could be read, you know, as a figurative thing. Not to get away from the religious, no, because the whole concept is a religious thing. But small works, more marketable type of things, and then a series of the Calcio in Costume. I did Gigi, and I did a few of them with the small costume stuff. So the big works, no, but more of the small ones. As far as the future thing is concerned, right now I've got to sort of dig myself out of a hole with after the Vatican thing, and I'm doing mainly workshops and small tours and stuff like that, just to keep something going. I've been trying to get the Cathedral of Perth to buy into a life-size series of sculptures of the Stations of the Cross.
That'd be awesome.
that they asked me to propose, which I did, but for them, they had just gone through a big restoration, $21 million, and they weren't ready for it. So I was told that I have to do like a video and like a visual sort of brochure. So that's in the works, but we'll see. So anything, just sort of a reestablishing the Vatican thing took a lot out of me physically, mentally, physically, spiritually, and stuff like that. So I'm just sort of trying to get back and try and find something stable. I mean, to be totally honest with you, anything stable right now. So that's where we're going. But right now, I've been working on these small little works.
I think that's a good idea to kind of not necessarily get away from the religious, but I have the same idea of working with the Western tradition rather than just, say, the Christian idea, but also like the Greek-Roman.
Exactly.
And put those forward in a contemporary, somehow contemporize them. Right. That would be, I think, very, very, very appealing to people, because it's part of the larger canon of what we are as a culture, and it's actually very important for us to do right now, I think.
Yeah.
It's all that we can do, is to show the value of our tradition.
Right. It's sort of like a renaissance. I mean, it's sort of like a going back to the Greco-Roman with the reconciled with the religious. And that's sort of interesting when you think about it.
And then reconciled also with the kind of contemporary aesthetic, right?
Exactly.
Because there is still beauty out there. Most of the beautiful things that are being done are actually being done in film, oddly enough.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I agree. I agree. That's where I'm going. But in fact, I might have to get going as well. I've got the little ones who are, I think, stressing out Loredan.
Yeah, of course. it's been 2 hours, anyway, so thanks so much, man.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
Good to catch
chat.
up. Yeah.